Hello, folks. Welcome to the LRIS podcast series. My name is Will Aitchison, and today we have another special COVID-19 podcast for you. Over the course of the last week or two, I have read dozens and dozens of COVID-19 policies from public safety agencies around the country, and I thought it might be helpful for everybody to come up with a list of the types of things you want to make sure your COVID-19 policy covers. And because I love lists and I love even numbers, I'm calling this podcast 20 Questions About Your COVID-19 Policy. Now, when I say I want to make sure that your COVID-19 policy covers, I mean something very specific like that. I'm just going to be raising the questions. From time to time, I'll talk a little bit about what I see to be the predominant practices out there in the public safety community, but mostly how you answer those questions is going to be a policy matter for you, for employers, for labor organizations. I just think it's important that your policy say something about this one way or the other. I want to raise the questions here, give you some examples of answers from people around the country, but mostly the idea here is to make sure that you have a thorough and complete policy. So with that, let's dive in. Question number one, do you have a policy? It's important to have a single policy somewhere. Most employers that I have seen, to the extent they have a policy, and really most do at this point, it's not in a single location. It may be a memorandum that was sent by this person, or it may be a bulletin that was sent by that person, or some change in rules. There may be some sort of letter of agreement or memorandum of agreement with the labor organization. And what you end up having are all these different pieces of paper or virtual paper that are not centralized. It's important for everybody in the organization, from the chief or sheriff on down to the firefighter or police officer or corrections officer, it's important for every one of them to be able to go to one source to find out everything. That way, mistakes aren't being made. Number two, does your policy call for a medical professional to be available on a 24/7 basis? Now, most do. Not everybody, of course, has the luxury of having an on-staff physician, although some major employers do. But smaller employers can all contract with physicians, and you see many of them doing that. Your policy should indicate who people can turn to for questions about COVID-19. It can even be a specialized medical professional other than a doctor. It could be a nurse or somebody like that who is doing the triaging. But there should be someone designated who can answer medical questions. Number three, now we're getting into the more substantive matters. Has the employer made arrangements for drive-through or other expedited COVID-19 testing? And if so, who can go through that testing? Can asymptomatic employees who are not in any particular high-risk group participate in the testing? I will tell you, most of the policies I've seen in the last few days as these things are evolving do in fact have provisions for expedited COVID-19 testing, and that means not just the sort of thing like drive-through testing that we've heard about, but also testing with testing companies that have a turnaround that is measured hopefully in hours, usually double-digit number of hours, rather than days. There are still stories out there of COVID-19 testing taking 8 to 10 days to get back. That's not going to work for a public safety agency. So you need to make sure that your policy has some sort of arrangements for expedited testing for your employees. Question number four, are your vehicles properly stocked with supplies? That would mean certainly at a minimum, disposable gloves, gowns, eye protection, contamination bags. It would mean ideally N95 respirators, even if you're in policing, an N95 respirator in every car, if that is at all possible. And I know it's not always possible. But you want to make sure that each vehicle that is being operated out there on the street by a public safety employee has a COVID-19 emergency health kit. Leave it to your medical professional to designate what should be in that health kit. There's probably going to be other things than the basics that I just mentioned. But make sure that the vehicles have those kits and every employee out there on the street has access to them. Question number five, does your policy require the routine cleaning and disinfection of stations, vehicles, and other work sites? Look, I know everybody is stretched to the max right now in terms of the work they are doing. And that includes both sworn and non-sworn personnel. And there's only so many hours in the day. But we can't forget, we can't leave behind the notion that it has now been firmly established from an epidemiological point of view that COVID-19 can live on surfaces, lives on plastic, for example, longer than metal, and that we need routine disinfecting, cleaning of all work sites. That should be something that is done just as a matter of course by employers, and the policy should require it. Okay, question number six. Let's start to talk about exposures. Does the employer have procedures in place, and are they laid out in the employer's policy for first responders who encounter an individual who is displaying symptoms consistent with COVID-19, either displaying symptoms consistent with it or actually who is known to test positive for COVID-19? Those are two alternatives, but both of them should trigger some sort of procedure that will kick in at that point in time. What is that procedure? It might be, for example, immediate supervisory contact. Any firefighter, any officer, EMS personnel, corrections officer who encounters someone who is displaying the prominent COVID-19 symptoms, I think pretty much everybody is in agreement now, that's going to be things like fever and dry cough and a general malaise or achiness. What kicks in? Well, first of all, contact your supervisor. That's in every policy that I have seen. Supervisor needs to ideally come out to the scene, but that's not always going to be possible. Your policy needs to indicate whether or not EMS transport is going to be appropriate for an individual who is displaying these symptoms. The policy should almost certainly say that that individual should not just simply be put in a police car. And if that individual is put into an ambulance, it's going to have to be one that is prepared to deal with individuals who are COVID-19 possible. Your policy should also indicate that PPE that is used to handle individuals who are displaying these sorts of symptoms, so gloves, for example, or a face mask, that they are properly disposed of or sanitized after use. And your policy just needs to talk about that encounter out there on the street from beginning till end and specify how it is your public safety employees should be dealing with these individuals. Next up, a series of related questions. I'm going to ask probably the same question three or four times here, but I'm going to vary some key words. So question number seven, if the employee as an on-the-job exposure to an individual who has displayed symptoms consistent with COVID-19, what does your policy say about that situation? So here, in this scenario, we're dealing just with individuals who have displayed symptoms consistent with COVID-19. We're not talking about an established positive test. So what about your policy and individuals on the street who display these symptoms? First question, does your policy define what an exposure is to that individual? Take, for example, an arrest situation where you have one officer who may be putting hands on a suspect to control the suspect, another officer who may be handcuffing the officer, may have some cover officers who are 2-3 feet away or 6 or 10 feet away or 20 feet away. Who is exposed for purposes of the policy kicking in? You need to define that in your policy, because that's going to trigger, of course, what happens after that exposure. Second question about this scenario. When employees encounter someone who displays symptoms consistent with COVID-19, someone is out there repeatedly showing a dry cough, for example, is the employee required to contact a supervisor? Say it in the policy, yes or no. Next sub-question here. Will that employee be ordered to leave work? You're going to make a distinction between whether or not the employee is symptomatic or asymptomatic. Whatever decisions you're going to make there, and this could well be one where that's a supervisory determination. Many policies I see make it a supervisory determination after the supervisor has checked with whoever the medical professional is to evaluate the other individual symptoms. Whatever it is you're going to do, put it in your policy. Next sub-question. If the employee is ordered to leave work, will they be ordered to self-quarantine? That could be, again, an automatic decision. Employees are required to self-quarantine. It could be a discretionary decision, usually with the involvement of this medical review officer, whoever it might be. But the policy, again, should say it, and it should say for how long the employee will be required to self-quarantine if the employee is going to be required to do so. And then lastly, where you have this situation where the employee has an on-the-job exposure to someone who is symptomatic but hasn't been diagnosed, how will the employee's time off work be handled? And on this one, boy, is it all over the map around the country. There are some employers who are saying the employee's time off is on the employee. The employee should draw down from accrued sick leave or vacation time or comp time or whatever it might be. That, from the policies that I have read and also from the news stories that I've seen, that is a small minority of employers. Most employers are providing some special form of leave for employees who must be quarantined to use. They call it all sorts of things. I've seen it, COVID-19 sick leave, COVID-19 leave. I've seen it just simply administrative leave with pay. One policy uses the phrase special sick leave. But the whole notion behind it, no matter what you call it, is that the time off work will not be charged against an employee's accrued leave account. Rather, that's going to be on the employer's dime. Now, the question you have is, if you're going to have this special sort of leave, paid leave for employees, how much leave do they get? And here, I've really only seen three scenarios. And the first scenario is one where the employee gets a fairly limited amount of time off work that theoretically coincides with the ability of the employee to get a COVID-19 test and get the results back. So this would be with employers that have very efficient systems of testing where the results can come back pretty quickly. And so you might see, for example, that employees who encounter someone who's simply symptomatic out there on the streets, that they might be able to come back to work in 3 days or 5 days or something like that. I will tell you, there are some serious medical questions about doing that, about bringing that employee back to work, because there are still open questions as to whether someone who has been exposed immediately shows up as a positive test. That's still being shaken out by the medical community. But nonetheless, some employers are doing that. That is a minority position. The other employers that I have seen are split into two camps. And in terms of predominance, I think roughly the first camp I'm about to describe has more, but is pretty close. I think we're kind of on a 60-40 basis. So what's the first camp? The first camp is employees get 80 hours of leave, of this special leave. Why 80 hours? That, of course, corresponds with 2 weeks, and that corresponds with what a lot of medical experts are saying is the period of time of the development of COVID-19 into full-fledged symptoms. The second camp, which I think is the 40-ish camp on the 60-40 margin here, the second camp is unlimited COVID-19 leave or administrative leave. Unlimited, at least until the point where it can be determined with certainty that the employee has not contracted COVID-19. All right, that's a very long question seven. Question eight about your policy is really question seven, but with a different phrase. What does the policy say about an employee who has an on-the-job exposure to an individual who has tested positive for COVID-19? So all of those same sub-questions. What does the policy say about contacting a supervisor? Will the employee be ordered to leave work? Will the employee be ordered to self-quarantine? If so, for how long? And how are you going to handle the employee's time off work? Special sick leave, or will the employee be required to draw down from his or her account? Most employers treat these two scenarios to be the same in terms of how they are handling it. The two scenarios being exposure to someone who's just symptomatic and exposure to someone who has tested positive. Most employers' policies that I've seen handle all these subsidiary questions. Are you going to be ordered to self-quarantine? How long? All that. Handle them the same in those two scenarios. Question number nine. If the employee has an off-the-job exposure to an individual who has displayed symptoms consistent with COVID-19, or who has actually been tested for COVID-19, what happens? What does your policy say about that? So this is kind of the same question, only it's off-the-job exposures to people who were either symptomatic or who have tested for COVID-19. Is the employee going to be required to notify a supervisor? Will the employee be required to leave work? How much sick leave? In what form? All of that sort of stuff. Same sorts of questions. You need to make sure you ask them there. By the way, I should have said this earlier, but we're going to post all of these questions online in the webpage that accompanies this this podcast. Now, I will say there are some policies that I've seen that treat off-the-job exposures differently than on-the-job exposures for the purposes of this special COVID-19 sick leave that employees would be getting, or administrative leave, and where you might be able to get it, that special form of paid leave for an on-the-job exposure, you might not be able to get it for an off-the-job exposure. Most policies, though, don't draw that distinction, and they treat all of these different exposure scenarios the same. And then the last of these related questions, question number 10, what if the employee displays symptoms consistent with COVID-19? Same subsidiary questions. Are they going to be ordered to contact a supervisor? Will they be required to leave work? Will they be ordered to self-quarantine? For how long? How will the employee's time off work be handled, and the like? Okay, question number 11. If your employee tests positive for COVID-19 but is asymptomatic, what happens? Well, once again, my point here is your policy should simply answer that question. Most policies require those employees to be quarantined that I've seen. However, there are a few employers who are just bluntly running out of bodies, running out of police officers or EMS personnel or correctional personnel. And so there are employees who, or employers, who actually have employees working who are tested, who have tested positive for COVID-19, simply because they don't have enough people. Now, they're not typically in their normal jobs. They're in some sort of job that might involve being self-quarantined, or they're in some sort of job, an office job somewhere, where they're not exposed to other employees. But there are a few employers, or at least we see news reports of these, where you do have employees who test positive being on the job. Doesn't seem like a good idea, right? And that's why most employers don't take that approach. Employees who test positive for COVID-19 are sent home or, in a worst case scenario, sent to the hospital. Okay, question number 12. If the employer learns that the employee tests positive for COVID-19, are there other employees who came into contact with that employee, not just employees, but members of the public? And if so, is the employer going to notify those individuals? Now, most employers that I've seen don't address that issue in the policy. They don't say it. I know of one employer that I've heard about that has raised, the phrase was HIPAA concerns. And this really isn't a HIPAA issue. As I've talked about in other podcasts, HIPAA doesn't really have much of a function in the public safety workplace. What this is really an Americans with Disabilities Act issue. The ADA has a privacy provision that requires an employer to keep medical information private. And the question is the disclosure of the employee's COVID-19 status, is that medical information that the employer is required to keep private under the ADA? And I think the answer to that is yes. And I don't think that there are any exceptions in the ADA that would apply. Mind you, we have no case law about this, at least none that I have seen. So I'm just expressing this view kind of off the top of my head. But the ADA is pretty clear. And not just the ADA, but the Equal Employment Opportunities Commission's regulations on the ADA are pretty clear that access to medical information, disclosure to medical information about employees, must be very tightly controlled on the part of the employer. What the employer can do is to notify all of those individuals who came into contact with the employee, other employees or members of the public, that the employer has information that they came into contact with an individual who was positive for COVID-19. without disclosing the name, without disclosing the symptoms. That wouldn't violate the ADA. All right, question number 13. Is the employer requiring doctor's notes for employees absent from work for COVID-19 reasons or for any other reasons? And I see a number of policies addressing this issue. Most of the policies right now are saying, hey, time out on doctor's notes, period. No matter what the doctor's notes are for, we're just not going to be sending employees to doctors to get notes commemorating the reasons for their absence from work. Now, that plays into, I don't know if you've heard this, but there's a long thread of a discussion about doctor's notes. It goes back many years. And there are a lot of management people who think that doctor's notes are fundamentally a waste of time and money and cause an employer to go too close to the edge in violating the ADA in order to get the information that they want. There's a lot of employers who simply don't like doctor's notes, but the majority have some practice with respect to doctor's notes and sick leave. That said, most of the policies I'm seeing are suspending those practices. And they're suspending them for a bunch of different reasons, right? First of all, the cost associated with it. Second, the notion of sending the employee to the doctor, starting the chain of phone calls or whatever happens to get that doctor's note. And the third, I think, is just a general social recognition that doctors have much better things to do right now than to be writing doctor's notes. There's an article that I read, I think it was in the Washington Post somewhere, written by a doctor. And the title of it was, "Don't Make Me Write Doctor's Notes During COVID-19. And I think the policy of suspending doctor's notes is for that social purpose. I will say there are several policies, many, I don't think it's the majority, but many policies I see that have an exception to the holiday for doctor's notes. And the exception is a very high-level exception, the ones I've seen. Someone at the chief level is going to have to make the exception. So where you have someone who you think is just very seriously gaming the system, the chief would have the right to get a doctor's note, order a doctor's note. Just as a reminder for everybody, your doctor's notes probably should not be, even in this time of pandemic, diagnostic doctor's notes. They should just be doctor's notes that verify the employee's need to remain away from the work site. Diagnostic doctor's notes have serious ADA problems. All right, question number 14. How does your workers' compensation and pension system treat employees who test positive for COVID-19? How does it treat employees who are simply exposed to COVID-19? However it is your system handles those situations, put it in your policy so everybody knows what the answer is. Everybody knows what sort of forms they need to fill out. Do they need to fill out whatever the number of the form is in your jurisdiction that logs a workers' compensation injury? Do they need to notify their supervisors in some sort of particular way? Just as a matter of practice, how is this thing being handled around the country? Well, so far, we're not seeing public safety employees having a whole lot of luck getting workers' compensation statutes amended at the statewide level to have COVID-19 treated as either a compensable injury or as a presumptive compensable injury where it is presumed to be caused by the job. And the reason for that's pretty easy. We don't have state legislatures that are in session right now, or very, very few. And so we're just not seeing any discussion of those laws. We are seeing it somewhere on a local level. For example, San Francisco, which, by the way, the San Francisco Police Department a shout out to them and the Police Officers Association in San Francisco. They've got a great set of COVID-19 procedures that are very well laid out. I can complain a little bit in that they're not all in one place. They're in a whole bunch of different documents. But they've really thought a lot of these COVID-19 issues out. I don't mean to send everybody calling the San Francisco POA. We will post on our website the pieces of the different policies that we have there. So at any rate, on the workers' compensation issue, in San Francisco, they have what's called a carve-out system. It's a carve-out system where they pretty much handle all of their workers' compensation issues on a productive, collaborative matter rather than using the traditional workers' compensation hearing system. We had a podcast about this a while back, an interview podcast, part of our premium series about how such a carve-out system works. We were using the Los Angeles Police Department as the model there. San Francisco follows that same sort of model. And in San Francisco, employees who test positive for COVID-19 are in the workers' compensation system, period, end of issue. It's not a presumptive causation situation at all. So my point is on this is really twofold. First of all, your policy needs to state what should happen from a workers' compensation perspective, if employees test positive for COVID-19 or are simply exposed to COVID-19. And secondly, perhaps more on a bit of a down-the-line basis, you need to be thinking about how your state laws or local laws on workers' compensation and on-the-job pensions, how those laws deal with a situation like COVID-19. Because unfortunately, I think as we've all learned, COVID-19 is a shot across the bow, right? We're going to be having other pandemics. And if we don't use COVID-19 as a learning experience for the future, shame on all of us. All right, question number 15. If the employer says to an employee, self-quarantine for whatever reason under the policy, the employer orders the employee to self-quarantine, what does the policy say about whether the employer will provide a prepaid quarantine location? And a prepaid quarantine location is just a complicated way of saying, will the employer get the employee a hotel room? So that way, the employee doesn't take their COVID-19 exposure or testing positive, whatever it might be, back to their family. So practices on this issue are kind of all over the map as well. But I'll tell you, I see a clear trend on this out there. And as we have more and more employees who are exposed, and as we have hotels that are closing because they have no business, and others that are open but have 5% occupancy rates, I'm seeing more and more employers provide paid hotel rooms for employees who are ordered to quarantine. I just want to point out to you that there's one more sub-question you have to consider about hotels or other prepaid quarantine locations. Do the employer's policies change if the employee who is ordered to be quarantined by the employer lives with one or more individuals who are at risk? So someone who may have, for example, a compromised immune system or a particular at-risk medical condition, heart disease, for example, or pulmonary disease, or maybe in their 80s, whatever it could be. Do the employer's quarantine at home policies change? I find that most employers haven't really thought through that permutation. And I think it's an important one to talk about because it might make sense for an employer to say to an employee who has been simply exposed to COVID-19 on the job, okay, you can quarantine at home, you know, follow all the procedures that everybody is recommending, get yourself into a separate bedroom, and make sure you're isolated from everybody else at home. That may make sense with an employee who has a family that is not in the special category. But that may make no sense at all from a public health standpoint if one of the members of the employee's family is undergoing, for example, cancer treatment and has a compromised immune system or perhaps has lupus or some other disease that puts them at a great deal of risk. So that's something I think policies and policymakers need to think about a little bit more than they have. Next up, question 16. Does the employer's policy say anything about the availability of flexible schedules for employees who have young children at home who now have special childcare needs because the schools for those kids have been shut down in response to the pandemic? If an employer is offering those sorts of flexible schedules, the terms and conditions of those schedules ought to be set forth in the policy. But wait a minute, you may be saying, didn't Congress pass about 10 days ago the Families First Coronavirus Relief Act, the FFCRA, and didn't it provide a special form of leave under the Family and Medical Leave Act for precisely these sorts of special child care needs? And the answer is yes, Congress did in fact pass that. But you may remember that Congress created an exemption, an optional exemption under the FFCRA. And the optional exemption applies to two different types of employees. The first are employees who fall under the category of healthcare providers. The second are emergency responders. Now, I mentioned that this exemption is optional. It's optional in an odd sort of way. The exemption can be invoked on a nationwide basis by the Department of Labor, the Secretary of Labor, or it can be invoked on an employer-by-employer basis by individual employers. Employers can just say, hey, look, we employ emergency responders. We are not going to provide this leave. And that is perfectly permissible under the FFCRA. What has happened in the last 24 hours is that the Department of Labor has weighed in on who an emergency responder is for purposes of this exemption. Now, when you see the term emergency responder, you can imagine that it might apply to some, maybe not all, police officers, almost all firefighters, but it's very hard to imagine that exemption applying to corrections officers because of the use of the word responder. Well, the Department of Labor has now weighed in on what that term emergency responder means. And no surprise to anybody, it is not an employee-friendly definition. I will post the link on our webpage to the Department of Labor's Q&As about the Families First Coronavirus Relief Act. You want to be looking at question 57. And this question asks, who is an emergency responder? And I'll just read you a couple of sentences that gives you the breadth of the Department of Labor's definition here. So who is an emergency responder? The Department of Labor says, for the purposes of employees who may be excluded from paid sick leave or expanded family and medical leave by their employer under the FFCRA, an emergency responder is an employee who is necessary for the provision of transport, care, health care, comfort, and nutrition of such patients, or, that's an important word, or whose services are otherwise needed to limit the spread of COVID-19. Now, here comes the big one. This includes, but is not limited to, military or National Guard, law enforcement officers, correctional institution personnel, firefighters, emergency medical services personnel, physicians, nurses, public health personnel, emergency medical technicians, paramedics, emergency management personnel, 9/11 operators, public works personnel, and it goes on for people who are in have special skill with respect to the operation or transport of equipment. So in other words, the Department of Labor is saying, if we, the Department of Labor, or individual employers invoke this exemption so that emergency responders will not get this special form of child care leave or the paid sick leave under the FFCRA, that exemption will apply to police, fire, corrections, EMS personnel, and dispatchers. Now, one last question. How many employers are actually invoking this exemption? Unfortunately, we don't know yet, and many of the policies we've been looking at actually predated the FFCRA. It's a very dicey political issue for an employer. I don't think we can overlook the complexity of the issue for employers. Because if you invoke this exemption, you're basically saying to employees, we're going to have two tiers of employees. We're going to have emergency responders and everybody else. And emergency responders don't get either of these two forms of leave, and everybody else does. Tough call for an employer. Question 17, make sure your policy talks about who can telecommute. Under the hunkered down in place rules that now the majority of Americans are under, there is a strong bias towards telecommuting. So who's going to be eligible for telecommuting? Say it in whatever your policy is. We don't have a lot of people in the fire service who are telecommuting. Some, some people who are not out there doing fire suppression duties and EMS duties and the like. We have some. We have more in law enforcement who are telecommuting. No corrections officers, or very few, of course, but in terms of police and deputy sheriffs and the like, we have more who are telecommuting. There are a lot of detectives around the country who are now telecommuting, people who are in crime analysis and, for example, media outreach, PIOs and the like. You see them telecommuting. In San Francisco, hearkening back to that policy, actually employees who are reaching the end of their work shifts are allowed to go home and basically telecommute for the remainder of their work shifts. And what does that mean? How does a patrol officer telecommute? The department is providing training for those employees. So they're taking care of some ongoing training needs through online training. Bottom line, though, whatever your telecommuting policy is, whoever gets to make those decisions as to which employees telecommute, what that chain of command is, say it. Okay, question number 18. Do first responders receive any form of hazardous duty pay? Look, when you're telling a firefighter or an EMT or a police officer, we are ordering you to go out on the street and we are ordering you to come into contact with people, put hands on people who are COVID-19 positive, you find some people wondering, should there be hazardous duty pay for those employees who are putting their lives at risk to do their job? And we are now seeing, we have now seen in the last week, we have seen our first deaths from COVID-19 around the country, and we're seeing more and more every day. Our first deaths on the part of first responders, that is, and first responders who contracted COVID-19 on the job. So it is logical that the hazardous duty pay discussion is one that is being had. But I will say, you don't see much of it. And the reason you don't see much of it, and I've heard this now from several unions, including several of our clients, who say, you know what, we realize we probably could go to the employer and say, look, we want 5% or 10%, whatever it might be, hazardous duty pay if we're out there on the street. And it's part of our jobs to actually come in physical contact with people who have COVID-19. But we are first responders, and this is our job. And we don't want to be seen by the public as being greedy or trying to take advantage of this situation. The optics are simply terrible. So not only for the altruistic reason, this is our job, and so we're not going to go ask for hazardous duty pay, but also for the optics. We are seeing public safety unions, police and fire and corrections unions, actually not even bring up the issue of hazardous duty pay, even though there have been internal discussions. I had a conversation yesterday, I think it was, with the president of a pretty good-sized police union who was talking about his members coming up to him and saying, why are we getting hazardous duty pay? And his answer to them all is all the same. We are not going to go there. We're not going to do it. But I'm talking about policies here. If you have hazardous duty pay, make sure you put it in the policy and make sure you define who gets it, clearly define who gets it. There are some agencies with hazardous duty pay. The small city, for example, of Bonnie Lake, Washington, has, as I read their policy, 10% hazardous duty pay. And it is triggered whenever the city shuts down its non-essential personnel, and all you have are police and fire out there on the street. And who's ever out there on the street gets this 10% pay. So it's out there. The hazardous duty pay is out there. It's just not very prevalent. All right, two more questions. Question number 19. How does the policy relate to the employee's regular leave accruals? So regular sick leave and regular annual leave. You need to be thinking about these things. So, for example, are you going to allow a relaxation of leave accrual caps so that employees don't lose their accruals? So it's very, very common, almost every place I've ever seen, has a cap on the maximum amount of vacation time an employee can have on the books at any one time, 240 hours, 480 hours, whatever it might be. Are those caps going to be temporarily relaxed during this period of COVID-19 response? Because, of course, employees can't take any of that leave during this period of COVID-19 response. They're going to be bumping up against those caps. Not only that, we have employers that have canceled leave and that has already been pre-approved for employees. In some cases, that leave may have been a week or two or three or even 4 weeks. You may have employees who have planned summer vacations with their families and the like. And the cancellation of the pre-approved leave puts the employee over the leave cap. So you want to deal with that issue. And the way to deal with it, I think, that makes the most sense is to provide a cessation of the cap. You simply stop the operation of the cap for the period of time we're in this heightened COVID-19 response. And then once you come back, the cap goes back into place, but it eases back into place, right? You don't snap back to, for example, 240 hours because the employee may immediately be over 240 hours. So you may give them, for example, employees 6 months to get back down to the cap level, allowing them to burn their leave or a year or whatever it might be. Just something you need to think about. Also, in terms of the integration with paid leave, Does your policy allow for borrowing of leave against future accruals? So say you have an employee who's using her or his own sick leave out there, and they're sick for so long because of COVID-19 or because they're quarantined or whatever it might be, that they now are running out of leave. Will your policy allow them to borrow leave against future accruals when they come back to work? Very few policies get that granular, but I think it's an important question, and it's going to happen, right? We know it's going to happen. So make sure that you talk about that in your policy. And then lastly, if the employer is following the Families First Coronavirus Response Act, the FFCRA, if the employer is not taking advantage of an exemption, do those benefits, the special paid leave that you see under the special paid sick leave under the FFCRA, and the heightened family leave, do they run concurrently with or in addition to the leave package that the employer is already offering? I haven't seen a policy that covers that issue yet, but it's one you need to think about. And that brings up a last point. It's not a last question. I did hit my 20 questions there, but it brings up a last point. Almost all of this stuff deals with either leave or workplace safety. Almost all of this stuff concerns negotiable issues. Now more than ever, it is important to have management and labor on the same page with respect to this stuff. Employers, and it's you that I want to encourage more now than unions, because unions are chomping at the bit on the point I'm about to make. But employers, you may have had a fractious relationship with your labor organization in the past. It may be a very difficult time. Worst case, it may be that the union has taken a no-confidence vote in a police chief or whatever it might be. You got to put that behind you. And you've got to have the union with a seat at the table. A seat at the table answering all of these 20 questions and the many more that will come up when you're having a discussion. And also a seat at the table when you're discussing operational issues, when you're discussing shift staffing or shift configuration. It is very, very important that everybody be part of the solution here. And you can't be in silos. All right, I've reached the end of this podcast. I'm sorry if I've sounded just a little bit more disjointed than normal. I'm recording this very early Sunday morning. I wanted to get this out just as soon as possible. And I'll tell you, folks, my heart goes out to all of you who are out there on the street doing our work for us. And I'm going to once again borrow from Michael Conrad in Hill Street Blues. Do stay safe out there, please. And with that, this is Will Aitchison signing off.